Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I'm very glad to have this opportunity to be co-leading this 10-day retreat with Joseph Babakro. As probably most of you have picked up, we've known each other for quite some years now. Joseph entered the monastic life when he was 23, and he was a monk for 20 years, and 23 years have passed since he left the monastic life. So, neatly arranged. And I stumbled into the monastic life 36 years ago when I was 21. So it's a few decades have passed, and so Joseph was the very first Buddhist monk I ever met and I spoke to. Before I went to Wat Pananachat, I had left England on an extremely vague a non-specific spiritual search, going to Asia to see if I could encounter some kind of spiritual training. I had never had any connection to Buddhism. I'd never even read a Buddhist book before going to Thailand and before walking into Wat Pananachat, which is the monastery of Ajahn Chah's Western students. So it was a very fortuitous day, January the 8th, 1978, when we met each other the first time. And it was unusual because I had only really gone there because I was in need of a place to stay. I'd gone up to the northeast to get away from the beach scene, the Western travelers. Backpacking beach scene, and I wanted to immerse myself into the Thai way of life. I had gone up to the remote northeastern provinces, and all I had was an address of some doctors who worked at a refugee camp. I'd just shown up at their house without any prior arrangement, and the doctors were away, but the other people who worked there, some nurses who also worked at the refugee camp, and made it clear that I was welcome to stay for one night, but I'd need to move on. So I asked them what were any kind of interesting or places nearby that would be worth visiting. And it was just after Christmas, and there were so few Westerners in that whole province that they'd all got together at Christmas time, and the people working at the refugee camp had gone to this monastery of Western monks to go and take them Christmas presents. And so this was fresh in the mind of one of the nurses there, who I was speaking to, with a very distinctive name of Delia Sparrowhawk. It's not a Californian name either. It's a genuine English classical name. She was from Deptford in Kent. So Delia Sparrowhawk, ever etched into my memory. And she said, oh, there's this monastery where these Western monks live just down the road. Maybe you'd be interested to go there. So being a hippie anarchist type, I thought, ooh, monastery. Rules. Mm. Yeah. Organized religion. Don't approve. But I thought maybe it'd be good for 2 or 3 days. And that was 36 years ago. So one of the reasons why I was distracted from my anti-organized religion beliefs was meeting Joseph. And so the when they said, oh, there's this monastery of Western monks, the vision that came into my mind was this kind of prune-faced ascetic with sort of thick glasses, with stern and forbidding aura. But when I met Joseph, he was the abbot of Wat Phananachat, and he was so completely ordinary, down to earth, friendly, and straightforward. I thought, well, he's all right. He's certainly not a prune-faced ascetic, and seems very nice, straightforward bloke. And then we met other monks and novices there, and they all seemed to be of a very similar nature. So while my mind was saying, but I object to organized religion, I don't believe in rules, sort of murmuring going off at the edges of my consciousness, what was happening in my heart was this very loud, yes, this is exactly what I'd hoped to find when leaving England and going on a search for some spiritual direction. So even though I knew nothing about Buddhism and never even heard of Theravada or Mahayana, never heard of Ajahn Chah, had never had any introduction to Buddhism in Thailand, just meeting the way of life of the monastery and the relationship between the village and the monastic community, I was immediately struck on a very profound and intuitive level. So I have a great deal of gratitude for Joseph having been the abbot and my teacher at that time. So he's my first Buddhist teacher. So he's responsible for me being here. to blame maybe. But I really do have a great deal of gratitude for Joseph. He also, I should let it be known, that he'd been somewhat unexpectedly thrust into that role of abbotship. Just to give you a little bit more Sangha history, about 8 months before then, in May of 1977, Ajahn Chah had been invited to England by George Sharp from the English Sangha Trust in London. And Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Khyentse Dhammo had come to England in May. And the plan had been that they would visit for a few months and then they would come back just before the rains retreat in July of 77. And Ajahn Sumedho would carry on as the abbot of the newly opened Wat Phananachat. I'm not quite sure how Joseph got the message, but somewhere along the line, about 2 weeks after they arrived, Lumpur Cha announced, Sumedho, you're going to be staying here in England. And to him and Ajahn Khyentse Dhammo, I'll go back to Thailand, you two stay here in London. So that was a shock to Ajahn Sumedho, since Wat Phananachat was only 2 years old at that time. And it was like a whole new venture, having a monastery for Western monks, but Ajahn Chah had this very strong intuition that this was an important aspect of his life as a teacher, and an extraordinarily significant potential was here in the West. So he just, without any doubt in his mind, said, Sumedho, you're staying, I'm going back. So that meant the next in line was Joseph. And so, to his surprise, I think he had six reigns at that point. He'd been a monk for 6 years, and suddenly was put in charge of being the abbot at Wat Phananachat. So that was definitely a case of having greatness thrust upon him. And so that was just after that time, in January of the next year, that I showed up. So I was very grateful for all the care and attention that Joseph gave during that time. And so I ended up staying at Wat Phananachat and never traveled on anywhere else, became a novice and then became a monk there under his guidance. So he taught me all the chanting, taught me how to weave a bowl stand, how to sew robes, and how to walk through a door with an alms bowl. Put the bowl down, open the door, pick the bowl up, walk through the door, put the bowl down, close the door, pick the bowl up, and then proceed. You do not open the door with the bowl in one hand and the door handle in the other. So I've been teaching people that ever since. And many other things. So this is a great delight now that we're kind of developing this kind of double act together all these years later. A couple of years ago, Joseph and I led a death and dying retreat. I think a few of you came and died with us during that time. And so I was very glad he was able to come back and for us to teach together, lead this retreat together this year. One of the themes that Joseph brought up a little while ago is about the samavayamo, this factor of the Eightfold Path, sometimes translated as right effort. Sama can mean right. It's more right as in upright rather than, and balanced rather than right as opposed to wrong. So right effort means balanced or attuned effort that is in accordance with reality. So that's samma. There isn't really a perfect English word that matches the Pali samma, but it has that quality of that which is in accordance, that which is attuned to reality, that which is balanced. So samma vayamo, right effort, or attuned effort, has these four attributes or four aspects to it. And Joseph went through those, but I thought I'd go through that again because this is really a sort of key element to understanding how development of effort works. So the four in Pali are Sangvara, Pahana, Bhavana, and Anurakana. So Sangvara, Joseph's sister, also happens to be on this this retreat. Sangvara means restraint, and so that's firstly the way of the Buddha. Rather than starting out with the positive side, you usually start out with the negative side. So the Four Noble Truths, you start out with dukkha rather than the ending of dukkha. You start out with the difficult, and you work your way towards the wholesome or the pleasant. So it starts out with sangvara, restraining the unwholesome from arising. So this is setting the intention to not allow unwholesome qualities to arise. So just like taking the precepts, we are saying, I undertake to refrain from taking the life of any living creature, to refrain from taking what's not given, and so on. This is a prime example of sangvara. You're setting the intention to not allow the unwholesome to arise, so that you are kind of putting that into place. So sangvara is restraining the unwholesome from arising. And then pahanati means to let go or to relinquish. So that means if an unwholesome state has arisen, if there's a feeling of fear or anger or jealousy, of craving, greed, selfishness and such like, if that's already arisen, then the appropriate response, the appropriate effort to make is to let go, to relinquish, to abandon that. So pahana is the second element. Then bhavana means to develop or cultivate. So consciously cultivating the wholesome. So like when we have the reflections on the universal well-being, may I abide in well-being, may everyone abide in well-being, the development of loving-kindness, that's a very common and central example of bhavana, the conscious cultivation of wholesome qualities, to deliberately bring the wholesome into being, bhavana. And then anurakana, rakha means to protect. Anurakana means to hold or to cherish, to protect, to maintain. So anurakana is to maintain in being. So if wholesome states have arisen, either on their own or if they've been brought into being through your own effort, your own intention, then anurakana is to nurture and to protect, to sustain those qualities. So there's a lot of doing. Obviously, this is about effort, and this specifies these different aspects of how that effort is most effectively applied. And the Buddha, as Joseph again was quoting the other day, he said, "My teaching is a teaching of effort. In a way you can call it Viryavada, the path of effort. In fact, in a way, Viryavada is more accurate than Theravada. It's more of an accurate term. It's the way of effort." He said, "My teaching is a way of effort. It's a way of energetic engagement. It's not a way that is, say, that is built around passivity." Some of the teachings common in the Buddha's time, other religious teachers, they taught a doctrine of non-doing or non-engagement, and their interpretation or their approach towards, say, detachment was to be not doing, to kind of trying to dissociate from the world altogether, and to, in a way, involve yourself as little as possible. So to do as little as you could, to move as little as possible, to eat as little as possible, to kind of not be. But the Buddha didn't take that approach, but he rather pointed out, "No, my teaching is a teaching of engagement, of effort. It's a path, and a path means, a path implies there's a traveling along that path. There's a definite directionality and an engagement that's needed." So I think it's a very important point, and in a sense the main theme of this retreat is that peace is not the same as passivity. Okay? Little soundbite, you can put that in your fridge. Peace is not the same as passivity. So that we we often think of peacefulness, or having a quiet day, having a peaceful day, sort of snoozing in the armchair, you know, lying at the beach, you know, relaxing, having a day, or having some peace, means switching off or disengaging or somehow, you know, unplugging. But it's very important to see that that's a worldly attitude towards peacefulness. I mean, it's very common for us. It's very natural. You know, oh, it's the sort of, thank God it's Friday. At last it's the weekend. Oh, I'm looking forward to my retirement. Looking forward to the holiday. Won't it be nice when I don't have to bother? Even the... phew. Now I don't have to meditate. I can be peaceful, you know. Because even the meditation turns into a thing I have to do. And so that we are quite strongly conditioned to just want to switch off, to stop, to not be, and to find peace through that kind of numbing or nullification or just sort of disengaging. But this is a central principle that you have in the Buddha's teaching, is that peace is not the opposite of action, but you can act. You can work and be experiencing total peacefulness at the same time. So the engagement of effort does not necessarily involve stress or burden or pressure. You can both be, engaged in effort, in action, in work, and yet the heart to be completely at peace. And what I was saying earlier today about the principle of still flowing water, that the body can be moving, there can be action going on, but that action can be seen to be taking place in the environment of total peacefulness, of stillness. Well, this is a different way of looking at action, because you know our condition, you know, it's natural enough for us to want to rest, and we notice that ringing the bell at the end of the sitting, there is a relief, not just because our knees can be released from there. their painful state, but also that what we're being relieved from is that sense of doing. Oh, that me doing this thing, even if me doing the meditation thing, it can so easily be turned into a chore. It's me who's trying to do this thing, trying to get it right, don't want to get it wrong. And that what is the burden is not so much the meditation, but it's the me on the one hand and the doingness on the other. What in Buddhist vernacular or Buddhist jargon we would call becoming. When we talk about becoming, it's a sort of Buddhist jargon word. But this is what is called in Pali bhava or bhavatana, the desire to become. That's what's burdensome. That's what is stressful to the heart. That me trying to get onto the next thing, me trying to get over there, me trying to be this, to get this, to do. And it's, I would suggest that it's the bhava-tanha, that desire to become, that me creating stress to get somewhere else, to become something else. That's what creates the tension in the heart, the feeling of stress and burden. And that it's through the unconscious habit of becoming. That's why we want relief from that. We want relief from becoming. If any of you have spent much time listening to Lumpo Sumedho's Dhamma talks, either hearing him speaking in person or hearing recordings or seeing teachings of his in various Dhamma books, you'll see over and over again, he says that the biggest mistake in meditation is the belief that I'm an imperfect person and I've got to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future. I've got to practice now so that in the future I will become enlightened. And over and over again he'll say this is the biggest mistake that we make. And in fact, just a couple of days ago he said to me, that's really why I got tired of teaching. I don't really want to teach anymore because people keep misunderstanding that they think you've got to do something now to become enlightened in the future. That's why I don't really want to teach anymore, because people keep mishearing what I'm saying. But many of you might be thinking, yeah, but I have got to do something now. I do want to be enlightened in the future, don't I? So this is why I feel that that it really helps. And during for this retreat, if there's one aspect of Dhamma practice that we can clarify, this is what I would really hope, to use a dangerous word, that we can clarify or can develop a deeper understanding of, is that when he's saying that to believe I'm an imperfect person, you know, I've got to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future, we might think, yeah, but I've read dozens of Buddhist books, I've heard hundreds of talks, and they all talk about, yes, you've got defilements, you need to get rid of your defilements, you need to develop all these good qualities. I mean, like 10 minutes ago, you were talking about cultivating the wholesome, letting go of the unwholesome. I mean, come on, Arjan, you were just telling us that that's all right effort. Come on, be consistent, please. But there's a subtle distinction that makes all the difference in the world, I would say. And this is a point I bring up over and over again, because when we have the belief that I'm a person, I'm an individual person who's got various kinds of imperfections, I need to get rid of my imperfections, I need to get rid of my greed, hatred, and delusion, I need to become more mindful, I need to develop concentration, I need to polish up my sila, my virtue, and I need to develop wisdom, and then if I develop enough wisdom, then I will become enlightened in the future. All that's got you might think, well, that's what it says in all these Buddhist books, and I think that's what it said in the, I'm sure there was something about this in the forms I signed, you know? You know, forms I filled out to come on this retreat, you know. This is, when I was describing what I wanted to do here, it was to get rid of my problems or become wise or develop more kindness. But if we look, we see that that's all cast into the sphere of I am this person. I've got these bits missing that I need to acquire. I've got these problems and bad habits I need to get rid of. And when, so there's a me here who's got to get this, get some wisdom, get this samadhi, and then when I've got that, then I will be complete. And we don't notice that we are creating a sense of self, creating this image of a me who's lacking these things and needs to get something in order to become that person over off there in the future who's an enlightened person somewhere over there. So what Lumpo Sumedho is pointing to in that statement of saying that's a dreadful mistake to consider I'm an unenlightened person who's got to do something now to become enlightened in the future is to say, you're not a person. to say, I am a person is immediately to identify with the body, with your thoughts, with feelings, with the mental states, and the Buddha's teaching over and over again. He points to, rupang anatta, the body is not self. Vedana anatta, feelings are not self. Sanya anatta, perceptions are not self. Sankara anatta, moods and thoughts, memories, ideas, intentions are not self. Vijnanang anatta, consciousness, the act of cognition itself. That is not who and what we are. These don't have an owner. These are not me, they're not mine, they're not who and what I am. So that if we start out with the view, I'm this person who's got these problems, I need to get rid of my problems, I need to become wise, become enlightened, then we're setting off down the wrong road. We're setting off in a direction based on a mistaken view. It's like we've got in our car, mindfully turned the ignition, mindfully driving down the road, and we've missed the fact that we're heading south instead of north. Yeah. We can feel that we're mindfully driving, carefully driving, watching out for the traffic, but we're heading in totally the wrong direction. So the key then to samavayamo, the practice of attuned effort, is that yes, the unwholesome needs to be restrained. Yes, if the unwholesome has arisen, it needs to be let go of. Yes, the wholesome needs to be cultivated. And yes, what wholesomeness there is needs to be sustained. But there doesn't need to be a me who's doing it. There's no I or me or mine involved in that, the development of the Eightfold Path. So during these days, hopefully this will be something that we can explore and look into more deeply. Because what creates the problems is where it's me trying to get rid of my scattered, my distracted thoughts, me trying to get concentrated, me trying to have more loving kindness, me trying to be more patient. It's the I, the me, the my feeling that's always distorting the picture. And that when there's a genuine practicing of the middle way, the development of the path, of following the path of the Buddha, there is the path is being followed, but there is no sense of self being created as a me who is doing something, me who is getting somewhere. Now these two look very, very like each other, and even in the words themselves. So bhava or becoming, on one hand, is the problem, is the that's the troublemaker, and bhavana or development meditation is the solution. So they can look very, very like each other, like bhava and bhavana. Even the words are written very, very similarly. But just like the left hand and the right hand, in some respects they're exactly like each other. In another respect, they're completely the opposite. So it works in it exactly that way. So that whereas bhavatana, the desire to become, or its partner vibhavatana, the desire to get rid of, they are always going to cause us difficulty. They cause stress and alienation, insecurity within the heart. That's the natural result of that following. And because bhavatanna is always I'm trying to be more patient. I'm going to develop my concentration. I need to get rid of these distracted thoughts. It's all cast in the form of I and me and mine. When it's samavayama, right effort, then rather than I have got these problems or I have got distracted thoughts, there it's a subtle shift. Oh, there are distracted thoughts. Distracted thoughts are arising. Obsessive memories or compulsive planning, endlessly speculating about the future, about the past. Oh yeah, there are a lot. There's thoughts. But we are able to see, well, those thoughts arise, they do their thing, they pass away. They don't have an owner, just like the rain falling on the roof. Do the raindrops have an owner? Yeah, we hear them, but they're not mine. We don't think of, that's my sound. When we hear the sound, when we hear rain falling on the roof or the birds singing outside the hall, like, well, that's my sound. That's my bird. You might think, well, that's my bird song. It's ridiculous. It's just the song of the birds. It's heard here, but to think that's mine, it's ridiculous. Or like, that's my cloud. You know, you can't have that one. That's mine. What? How do you own a cloud? You know, it's ridiculous. But yet, the thoughts and feelings that arise within us, we grab hold of them. That's my cloud. That's my memory. That's my plan. That's my idea. You know, that's my insight. it's as absurd as claiming a raindrop or a bird song or a cloud passing through the sky. So hopefully during these days we'll begin to discern the contrast between these when they're, let's say, they're on the one hand, literally, what is samavayama, the cultivation of attuned effort, where there's these qualities of samvara, pahana, bhavana, and anurakana, of restraining the unwholesome, or letting go of the unwholesome, cultivating the wholesome, maintaining the wholesome, and to see how those can be carried out without that being based on I or me or mine. And then also similarly getting to know the flavor of becoming when the heart is caught in, but I've got to, I should, and I want to, but now I've got it, now I understand. the flavor, the texture of that I and me and mine, that feeling, because it's that feeling of I-ness, me-ness, minus, it's just like the weight of the body. You know, that, I mean, how how many of you wake up in the morning and go, gravity? Yeah, it's happening again. It's because it happens all the time. It's not news. Isn't it? Like no newspaper is ever going to have gravity is operating again today. Yeah. It's not news. It just does its thing every day in the same way. It's nothing special. And so similarly, the feeling of I and me and mine is exactly the same. It's like, oh, here it is. But just like when I talk about gravity and the weight of the body, I use that word, suddenly we notice, oh yeah, I can feel this body pulled to the earth, right? There is weight. It's an experience. So if we put attention on it, we can notice it. If we don't put attention on it, it's nothing that's going to grab our attention. It's not compelling or interesting. It's completely ordinary. So we need to, in a sense, work to get to know that feeling of I've got to, I should, I shouldn't have done that, I should do this, I shouldn't be this way, I should be that way. To get to know that, what is called ahankara, the I-making, mamankara, the mind-making habits. To get to know the texture, just like when we bring attention to our weight, you can feel the earth pulling this body to it. Right, wow, that's really strong. Wow, well, how come I miss this? This is really intense. And in a similar way, when we get to know that feeling of I-making and mind-making, there's that same kind of recognition of, whoa, look at this thing go. It's this me, 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 me. God, this is going on all the time. How did I miss this? It's like yelling at me all day. How come I was ignoring this? How come this wasn't so totally obvious before? So getting a sense of that, getting familiar with that that texture, to get to know that quality, so that when that's apparent, then we, okay, this is the mind selfing. It's doing that I, me, mind thing. Okay, don't believe it. Let go of that, to drop that, to not be caught up in that habit, that I-making and mind-making habit, that conceiving, also the The Buddha used the word manyati, to conceive the self-forming habit of mind. And it's also, like any habit, it's a habit that can be dropped. We don't have to be limited or bound by that. Also, earlier today we were talking about listening to the mind, learning to listen to our thoughts. I was using the example of listening to our thoughts the same way that we hear the bird song. And when we hear the birds, we might think, oh, beautiful, lovely songs that they're singing, tweet, 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 tweet. Now, some of you maybe are ornithologists or bird watchers, and you know that they're not going kind of singing little arias for our pleasure. They're saying, this is my patch, back off or I'll rip your head off. You know, like, come over here, darling. You know. Yeah. Let's make a home together. You know. That they have their own little kind of bird politics going on that we're not aware of. We can't understand their language, but it's not quite as sweet and benign as I think we would guess. But we just hear the sound of the bird song. We don't know what the content is. But we hear the sound of the rain falling on the roof, and we don't. It doesn't have a particular meaning or message. Maybe the bird song does, but the rain certainly doesn't. Or the sound of the wind through the trees. And we can learn to listen to our own thoughts with that same kind of non-interest, non-entanglement. We can learn to hear our own thoughts. I like to use the example of just as if you're living in town, you have a flat or your house, and it's summertime, the windows are open, and somebody's out in their garden and they're playing the radio in the garden. And you're not interested in what's on the radio, you didn't even choose the station, but the sound is coming across the fence and you're hearing it. But you hear words, the words are sort of rattling on, and they make sense, they're informed sentences, but you're not interested, you didn't choose it, but it's there. So we can relate to our own thoughts in exactly the same way. It's just like the neighbor's radio. We don't have to make much of it, we don't have to take our thoughts seriously, we don't have to buy into their content. As I think Joseph was saying, just because you think it doesn't mean it's true. This is a very strange delusion that we have as human beings, is that we tend to assume that just because a thought goes through our mind, it's some kind of accurate judgment. I would suggest this is a very, very weird thing to believe. It's like, would you say that everything that you hear on the radio or on TV is absolutely true and reliable? Yeah. I mean, if I say that statement, you know, how many of you would go, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. Right? Yes, I'm getting a few nods around the room. Yeah, yeah, because it's just on the TV, or it's just something you hear on the radio. But yet, the thoughts that go through our mind, we take to be absolutely bona fide, 100% accurate representations of reality. Even when our thoughts this morning contradict our thoughts this afternoon, we assume that they're both true. So this is very, very weird for us to be believing our thoughts all the time. So I really encourage us to, in a sense, change the attitude towards thinking. So obviously, with meditation, we're trying to focus the attention on the present. We use, say, an object like the breath to help, keep the attention attuned. But if you try to suppress thought, or you try to wipe it out just as an act of will, you tend to make it stronger, you make the compelling quality of it even more intense. But just shifting the attitude towards it, just to assume that it's just noises in your head, it's just like the rain falling on the roof, nothing you need to be particularly interested in or worked up about, some kind of memory or a plan or some kind of opinion, you can relate to it just sort of murmuring along. Like, also often give the example of the Charlie Brown cartoons. If any of you are familiar with Peanuts, you know, if you've noticed, Only the children and the animals have meaningful things to say. If an adult ever appears in the Peanuts cartoons, all the adults ever say is gack, 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 gack. They never, it's assumed that an adult never has anything meaningful to say. Only children and animals have things that are worth, that have any kind of substance to them. If it's an adult speaking, it's just kind of grown-ups, it's just the grown-up jabber. Gack, 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 gack. You know? Obviously, if it's a grown-up talking, there's nothing useful, there's nothing important going on there. So we can just relate to our own thoughts in that way, just gack, 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 gack. And you might be thinking, well, my thoughts are very significant. Your thoughts might be just sort of gack, 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 gack. But, you know, my thoughts are very significant, well-formed, extremely articulate, erudite, and true all the time. And but I would also encourage you just to recognize that judgment as another thought. And that we slowly are able to do is to let go of the content of thought, and just to be able to witness the process of thinking, just as we witness the process of hearing, of feeling in the body, of the changing colors and forms and shapes of the day. Because as we watch the mind and develop the heart of knowing, that awareness which is able to receive all the content of experience, like the heard, seen, smelt, taste, touched, the thought, that awareness, that knowing that receives and is conscious of all experience, the more we're able to let go of the content of thoughts and feelings, perceptions, the more the heart is able to simply be that quality of awareness itself. In essence, this is what we mean by taking refuge in the Buddha, being awake, being aware, being that knowing quality. And we begin to see how much we create the world as we experience it. If you're in a good mood, everything is bright and cheerful, then everything that you hear, or the thoughts, the feelings in your mind, they exude a quality of brightness. They're encouraging, they're inspiring, they're beautiful, they're charming. If you're in a depressed and miserable, painful mood, everything is irritating. The same things, the same sound. You might think, oh, beautiful bird, oh, such a clear sound, so glorious, so pure, so innocent. If the mind is in a good mood. If it's in a negative mood, it's like, yeah, Ajahnamo's right, they're probably just swearing at each other and competing, just red in tooth and claw, the brutal animal world is so hopeless and painful. Poor wretched beings, all they do is suffer. It's just a sound, but we read different things into it. Many years ago, I was having a conversation with a friend of ours, a Zen teacher in Oregon, in Chosen Bays, and she was the place that they used to have their center was called Larch Mountain. It's on the Columbia Gorge, and she was conducting a Zen session one summer, and it was a really intense heat wave. And they had pretty basic buildings at that place, and their zendo was a kind of Nissen hut, it was sort of a curved roof, sort of barrel-shaped building, and it was like got corrugated iron, and so it was a real oven. It was like baking hot inside this zendo, and they're about 3 days into this heat wave, and they're all just cooking inside, and so she had this idea: we've got the sprinklers. What if we rig up the sprinklers so we can spray water on the roof of the zendo, cool it down, so that we won't all be cooking? Because they're a very, very strict outfit. And once you've started a session, you can't just move to a different site or just have a day off in the woods. Or, it's like, you start, you have this rigid routine that's got to happen. Otherwise, the sun will stop rising in the east. So they had to keep on with the session, but she thought, okay, right, I'll get the sprinklers on. So she put the sprinklers from the garden, and directed them up over the roof of the zendo. So it was water was falling on the roof of the zendo, cooled everything down. And in the Zen tradition, they have interviews with the teacher every day. It's little short 5-minute interviews with the teacher. It's called Dokusan. And so she said that after she had this brilliant idea of putting the sprinklers on in the zendo, then during the next session of the interviews of Dokusan, it was a very interesting sequence of encounters. The interviewee, the student comes in, they sit face to face with the teacher, and then they're supposed to simply express what's on their mind. And so the teacher will maybe have a question like, "How is it?" And so one after another, she asks the same question of the students. So, "Well, how is it?" And the first person said, "Well, I've got a much better idea of how to cool down the zendo. You know, I think it's a good idea that you had the water, but I think it'd be far better if we got these swamp coolers in, or that they're much more efficient than air conditioning, very eco-friendly. And I think if we put it, we arrange a swamp cooler at this end, they're a bit noisy." Carried on like that for 5 minutes. Ding. That interview was over. Next one came in and said, "I'm absolutely incensed. How could you waste so much water? Don't you realize how valuable this is? This is an absolute affront. This is an insult to Mother Earth. Wasting all this water just for our comfort. This is outrageous. You should be struck off as a Dharma teacher. This is totally irresponsible and awful. And so I'm intensely angry at this moment with you." Ding. "How is it?" "The sound of the water forms this glorious celestial music. How did you know this is what we were missing? This is the most divine, beautiful, abundantly fantastic, splendid experience. We were primed by these days of heat and sweat, and now we have this glorious shower of beautiful music falling upon us." Ding. And one after another, each person had a completely different experience with the sound of the water. Another one was that they were hearing voices. They think, "Well, I'm not sure where the recordings are coming from, but there are distinct Dharma teachings I'm getting. I know it sounds like water falling on the roof, but I know I shouldn't be asking you in the Dokusan, but have you got a PA system that you've rigged up? Because I'm hearing teachings. There's definitely, but I can't quite get the words. But it's there." Obviously with an American accent. But I won't try and inflict my American accent upon you. But one after another, and after about four or five of these, five or six, she was thinking, okay, well, what next? And each person that came in, everyone was obviously affected by the sound of the water falling on the roof, but everyone had created a different universe out of that sound. It was such a striking instance of the mind creates the world. The mind is the forerunner of all things. So what the mind does with the raw substance of experience. So just as the days go by, the hours go by, then just to watch that kind of fickle and fluid nature of the mind, how our moods change, just like the weather, fantastic English June weather, bright blue, clear, down comes the rain, bucketing down, then clears again, then the wind comes up, and it's a sharp biting wind, and then the wind stops and the rain comes down again. So it's like as if you had the word clue. This is a clue, it's changeable. But just like the weather, our minds, our feelings are exactly the same way. This is a clue that we're missing, the sort of obvious clue that nature changes, the mind changes, the body changes. And just as There's no such thing as good weather, or you know, the right weather or the wrong weather. It's like you can't have a right or a wrong mind. It's just this mind. And there are moments where it's clear and bright and benign and beautiful, and times when it's painful and stormy and contorted and confusing, and everything in between. This is how the mind is. And so we are developing the practice around, I think, cultivating the wholesome, letting go of the unwholesome. But essentially, that process is effected, is brought into being by the development of consistent awareness, a constant mindfulness, that establishment of the refuge of awareness, being that space within which the beautiful and the ugly, the pleasant, the painful, the neutral, the benign, the familiar, the weird, being that space within which these all appear. Then we're not investing in the and grasping the good or fearing and rejecting the painful, but learning how to be that still, silent, knowing, that being that space within which it all appears, takes shape and dissolves. And rather than believing in our perceptions that, you know, there are voices in the water, you know, I can tell, you know, they've got messages for me, you know, or that it's celestial music, or whether it's an outrageous waste of water, just to see what our mind is doing with the moment, doing with this mood, doing with the weather, doing with the way we relate to our fellow retreatants, or the teachers, the people caring for us in the office, in the kitchen, in the retreat center here. We begin to see how the mind creates the world, and that in that seeing of that creation, then we're able to know the world, to be the lokovidu, knowing that which knows the world rather than that which is grasping and identified with the world. And then in a mysterious way, that through exercising that effort to be awake, to know, then rather than that creating a kind of dissociation or ourselves sort of cut off from the world, but the more completely and wholly we let go of the world, we kind of release the grip of becoming, we release that entanglement, we find ourselves more attuned to the world. It's a strange process whereby this happens. It's a mysterious thing. By letting go of the world, you find yourself fully attuned to the world. And that balance, this is really the essence of the middle way, both fully with the way things are, but also fully detached and unentangled with the way things are. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.